Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
And now, a few minutes with U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Blumenthal. Obviously still at top of mind is what's going on in Afghanistan. And I know earlier this week, you and Senator Chris Murphy were against the idea of pulling our troops August 31st, which is the president's plan. What do you know about the people still left in Afghanistan who have yet to evacuate and are from here, either in Connecticut or the United States in general?
What we know as of yesterday, I haven't seen the latest figures, is there's still more than 1,000 Americans there who want to leave. And there probably are thousands of Afghan allies, that is, the interpreters, translators, guards, drivers, people who sided with us at great risk to their lives, some of them in combat next to our troops. And so we have an obligation to them. It's a moral imperative. And I must say, I'm particularly proud of the veterans all across the country, and particularly in Connecticut, who have endeavored to enable those Afghan allies, many of their own interpreters, to leave the country, because they essentially have targets on their backs, and so do their families. So there's still tens of thousands of people. The estimates range from 30,000 to 100,000. But my point is, and I think Senator Murphy shares this view, we have a moral obligation to stay as long as necessary for the limited purpose of enabling those Afghan allies and, of course, United States citizens to safely depart Afghanistan when they may be in mortal danger there.
This morning, Senator Blumenthal, I'm reading that the Kabul airport is under a terror threat from a branch of ISIS, no friend of the Taliban, but definitely an enemy of the Western forces. And the U.S. embassy is noting a security threat outside the gates against the desperate crowds gathered there trying to get out. So it just seems like it's only getting worse and worse. So I know that you would like to keep our forces there, but it seems like at this point we're just in a losing situation.
We've been in a losing situation for a while, Melissa, and we need to do a very clear-eyed, penetrating, unsparing analysis of what went so terribly wrong in Afghanistan, not just in the last 30 days or 30 weeks, but over the past years. And that would include the most recent weeks when we've seen an unfolding nightmare, a humanitarian crisis. My point is that we need to enable the U.S. citizens, certainly, and as many of our Afghan allies as possible to leave by August 31. If we haven't finished the job by then, we can't let the Taliban dictate the terms or the timetable of our withdrawal if American citizens are still there in danger seeking to leave.
Senator Blumenthal, I think what is still a concern so many days later, I know our focus has been on the evacuations for very good reason, but I think this question's been prompted a lot and there's still not really a clear answer. Why wasn't this reversed? When we knew we were going to pull people, why didn't we just start evacuating before pulling our forces all together? And why did we leave weapons there for the Taliban to basically take over and have the upper hand on us?
What we need to know, Melissa, and I've suggested we need to have hearings. I'm on the Armed Services Committee. I believe we'll have hearings, so will the Foreign Relations Committee, to report to the American people an answer to exactly those questions. Why was the evacuation delayed? I will tell you, I went to the White House last April. I spoke to members of the President's National Security Team in the State Department and other agencies and urged that the evacuation begin en masse back then, months and months ago.
What did they say to you when you said that?
I was alone. Essentially, without revealing those discussions, which are classified, and I wish I could talk about them, they had, in my view, no good answer. And I think they were under the assumption that the evacuation would not be as immediate or hasty as it later proved to be.
I mean, Senator Blumenthal, in your professional opinion, there wasn't a way back in April, if we knew we were going to pull troops this summer, there was no way to kind of get a secret notice out to evacuees to say, hey, we're going to pull troops in the next 3 months. You should probably start making plans to get out of here. There was no good way to do that?
That is exactly the opposite of what I've been saying, Melissa.
Right.
There was a way to do it. I urged that the administration adopt various ways, not just one. There was a number. The president, as a matter of fact, talked about mass evacuations to Guam at some point. Nothing seemed to go anywhere with that plan, at least on a substantial basis. So the simple answer is we need to focus more broadly on what went wrong, not only in the last few weeks or months, but on the last years, because that lens is important to understand why the Taliban were able to consolidate their control so quickly. It was just a matter of months and weeks that it took the Taliban to crush the Afghan government, which we devoted years to build, and many, many American dollars, and even more important, American lives. So there needs to be an accounting, no question about it.
And I'm curious, Senator Blumenthal, I remember when former President Donald Trump wanted to pull our troops, he got a lot of backlash. President Biden now has pulled our troops. He's now getting a lot of backlash. So I'm curious, are we not, is it not the president who made this decision, essentially? You're saying it's people who work under the president who made the decision to pull our troops before we even thought about the evacuees?
President Trump agreed to the deal with the Taliban to withdraw our troops. He set the date as May 1. President Biden made the decision to withdraw our troops. He extended the date to the end of August. So very definitely, those two presidents are the ones who made the decision. Now, President Biden was, in effect, stuck with a situation not completely of his making. There already was an agreement by President Trump. There were weaknesses in our position. He had no part in recent decisions. So I think we need to look back, not just at the last few months, but really over the years, see whether we can learn lessons over previous administrations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just kind of to your point, Senator Blumenthal, if former President Trump made the call for May 1st, and even President Biden made it for later on in the summertime. Either way, we had months to figure this out, which I think is speaking to your point, if I'm not correct, that we had months to figure out getting people out. And I'm just wondering who's responsible, who dropped the ball on this, and why are now hundreds of lives possibly in grave danger?
And that's a question the American people deserve answers to. My focus right now, and some of these questions can be answered only by the people who were there, and they should tell the American people, either in testimony in Congress or otherwise. My focus is on evacuating as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. Fortunately, the numbers have increased dramatically to the tens of thousands now. I was just informed at the early mornings of today that another family whose fate we were working on in my office, along with veterans, they really stepped up, as I mentioned earlier. Veterans in Connecticut and around the country have played such an important role in helping many of these individuals, our Afghan allies, to leave the country and their families. But we're continuing to focus on their fate and the fate of American citizens.
Senator Blumenthal, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate you talking about this.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
What will this year's back to school look like? Melissa in the Morning chats with local educators to find out. Now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
And we are in Stamford now, where we're checking in with Superintendent of Public Schools in Stamford, Dr. Tamu Lucero. And good morning, Dr. Lucero. Thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm doing really well. Excited about the new school year starting.
Yeah, I would think most teachers and faculty members are just excited that this looks a little more normal than we were thrown into last year. How are your teachers feeling this week?
They're feeling pretty good. They came back on Wednesday for professional development. Our new teachers returned on Monday. And so the excitement is here. And it's really nice to see all of us walking back into a school building. So mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a great year.
Let's talk about walking back into school buildings, Dr. Lucero, because I understand, like many school districts across Connecticut, in fact, I would argue almost all of them, you guys are not offering remote learning, correct?
That's correct. And this is something that I think we did well here in Stanford. We actually offered a separate distance teaching and learning academy last year for our students, and teachers were able to teach from their classrooms and engage all of our students who selected that as a model. And so we thought we had a really good program here in place, and we actually were planning to offer that for any student who was not age eligible for the vaccination. And with the new guidance that came down from the state, we had to step back from that. So we are now working with individual families who are in need of a thought about remote learning. They have to submit something to us, and you're really talking about now our special education students, our 504 students, and any sort of student who needs to quarantine or have an at-risk family member at home.
And I'm curious, Dr. Lucero, correct me if I'm wrong, but was Stanford one of the districts that really struggled with absenteeism last year?
I think it's a place that we always want to make sure that we know that all of our students are coming to school. And we did a lot of work with our community partners to get people walking from door to door, knocking on doors to try to see why students were struggling with coming back to school. And so, and as we reopened for more in-class instruction, the better our attendance got, actually.
Okay. So I'm curious, are you worried, though, in the beginning half of the year when basically the only option we had was virtual learning across our state? Are you worried that kids will feel behind or fall behind in this upcoming school year?
So one of the things that Stanford was able to do this summer is offer our largest summer school ever. We had over 5,000 students who attended summer
Wow.
school, over 600 employees who helped us run that summer school program. So we had academic programs in the morning and partnered with our community partners to do enrichment in the afternoon. So I think Stanford's well on its way to helping to help with some of that expected loss. And then we also are going to run 3 8-week after-school and Saturday programs to also do some recovery work with our students and acceleration work with our students.
Dr. Tamu Lucero is here. She is the superintendent of public schools in Stamford. And Dr. Lucero, I did want to switch gears and just talk about the school buildings. I have talked to Mayor Martin about this countless times on our show. The fact that there were issues of air filtration and maybe mold issues in some of the buildings. And coming off of COVID, I know there was a huge push to invest in fixing some of those things. Now, that's very expensive, and it's not just like a quick fix. So could you give us an update on where our buildings are at for Stanford schools and what's kind of the near future? What does it look like?
Yeah, there's a few things going on here because we have been working on the repair and maintenance of our schools over the last few years. I think you know there were some mold conditions in some of our schools 3 years ago, and as Mayor Martin probably shared with you, they have our Board of Reps and Board of Finance have invested quite a bit of money into our schools. I think we have invested nearly $60 million to address a lot of the issues, but we do have aging buildings here in Stanford, and so we have created a long-term facilities committee that is made up of our Board of Reps, Board of Finance, the operations members of our Board of Ed, our planning board, and members of our state delegation delegation, and we are working together to come up with a plan for how we are going to, and we're in an assessment mode right now. We put out an RFP, and now a company is assessing all of our schools, and we really will have a master facilities plan in place somewhere around November. And we did put in two applications to the state to address West Hill and a school at Lockwood Avenue. So we're not where we want to be, but we've done a lot of work in that area. And in terms of any sort of mold in our schools, certain conditions in the weather really do allow for mold to come into our homes or into our schools. And so, but we have a plan in place that we're able to address any of those issues that come up immediately.
Do you mind sharing that plan, Dr. Lucero? Like, what happens, as you mentioned, if that happens?
I can tell you very clearly. So what happens is that the teacher, if they see anything, we have a say something, it's reported to their building principal. The building principal reports it to their associate superintendent, who works with our facilities manager to have a hygienist come out on site, do some visual assessment, and come up with a plan for what needs to happen. And they write out a plan, and that's given to the remediation company, and that is remediated. And usually that's able to happen in just a couple of days.
Okay. In the meantime, though, while that process is going on, would kids be going back to remote learning or put in a different classroom?
Oh, no, yeah, we just transition them to a different classroom.
Gotcha.
And if we see it in the evening, sometimes you're able to address it overnight.
Okay, all right. And my last question, with air filtration coming out of COVID, are the schools up to code with that? If not, what is sort of the alternative?
Yeah, so we have one of the recommendations that came out of the state is that we do a recommissioning of all of our schools. We did this last year also. They go around, they check all the HVAC equipment to make sure that it's up to par to the COVID standards, and we have done all, we're in the process of doing all of that now, and we will be in a good place at the start of the school year. Because we do have aging buildings, we have a facilities manager that spends probably 100% of his time just working on our HVAC systems, making sure that their controls are in place to make sure that they're up to par.
Dr. Tammy Lucero, who is the superintendent of schools in Stamford, we thank you so much for taking the time. Good luck in this upcoming year. Would love to have you back on the show really soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. Welcoming to the show this morning, Mark Donald, who's the executive director of Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership, also known as RYASAP. And we're talking this morning to Mark about working to connect recent high school graduates and non-grads in Bridgeport to career pathways and post-secondary education. Mark, thanks for coming on this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this effort. Where did this come about? Why are you guys getting involved with this?
Sure. So late fall, early winter last year, we were approached by the MDRC, which is a research and policy organization, primarily based out of New York City, but they're nationwide as well, about selecting two cities across the country to study and do some action research on connecting high school graduates during a recession. Obviously, this is a pandemic-induced recession, and connect them to career pathways, not just jobs. So around February, they selected Bridgeport as one of the two cities and are in the final stages of actually selecting the other city to study for a 15-month project.
So what are you hoping comes out of this?
So, I think the biggest thing that we would like to come out is a best practice for how to establish a continued relationship between public school districts, the profit community, the nonprofit community, and the post-secondary education options, whether it's community college, four-year college, or training, to establish a pathway for careers for young people, primarily ones that typically are not sure what they want to do at the next stage of their life.
What would you say, in talking about this, what would you say is one of the biggest reasons why kids are not continuing on to either college, different careers, secondary schooling, especially as you mentioned, they're looking at like the Bridgeport area? Why would you say we are unsuccessful or not as successful as we can be in that area?
I think, quite frankly, you know, as public school systems, we don't do a great job of exposing them to what options are out there, particularly that focus on the strengths and interests of the young people. You know, for example, we've had a few different employers come in and present, and, you know, they don't think they we had, for example, the Greater Bridgeport Transit Authority come in, and instantly a young person would think about, you know, a bus driver or somebody driving a train or a clerk selling a ticket. And in reality, there's people who do graphic design for the company. There's people who do marketing and outreach. There's people who do, you know, organization and management. So something as simple as that for a graduate who may be artistically inclined or, you know, technologically inclined, graphic design, there's a career option and a career pathway that may or may not require some post-secondary education, but certainly could get them on the pathway up to a professional career in it.
Mark Donald is here. He's the executive director of Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership. And we're talking about getting that connection, an initiative that is trying to connect recent high school grads or even non-grads in Bridgeport to career paths and even post-secondary education. So first of all, let's go back for a second, Mark. What is Regional Youth Adult Social Action Partnership? Like, tell me about the work that you guys do.
Great. Thanks for asking. RYASAP is how we're known around town, especially in southwestern Connecticut. But we have seven distinct programs that primarily focus on kind of disadvantaged, disengaged, underserved populations. We work with Bridgeport Public Schools around restorative practices. We do advocacy at the state level around youth justice. We do diversionary programs for young teens and adolescents. We also do gang and gun violence prevention. And then the other program, I forget, we have a couple other programs, including two AmeriCorps programs, Public Ally and Prevention Corps, which focus on leadership development and substance abuse, respectively. And then we work on some education and advocacy around substance abuse, mental health, and addiction services. So we're kind of a one-stop shop that tries to work on establishing awareness and direct service and capacity building for those that have been exposed to trauma.
And according to the release that we got from your group, the Park City Career Pathways Initiative is going to be focusing on at least 400 of these young individuals from Bridgeport. And again, over the course of a 15-month project, the initiative will be directly supporting these recent grads or even non-grads by looking at different programs that they could get into, developing different opportunities, connecting them with resources, providing workshops, training, support. Is there a way, Mark, that if parents are listening right now, they are thinking of a young one either in their family or someone in their community who could benefit from this, is there a way that they could, like, apply to be part of this 15-month course or anything?
Absolutely. The easiest way for everybody is to check out the Park City Career Pathways Facebook page and send us a note there, and then we can have one of our case managers or the director reach out to engage and kind of get them acquainted with what our goals and what the action steps are. You know, also ryasap.org. You can send an email to ryasap@ryasap.org to get connected to the program, and we'll do the legwork from there. In mid-September, we're going to start hitting the streets and knocking on doors of those graduates that we've been unable, or non-grads, as you said, who we've been unable to reach so far as well. So we're going to be proactive, and we're hoping that through mechanisms like yourself that folks will reach out to and become aware of the program.
Mark Donald, we so appreciate it. And again, the website is RYASAP, RYASAP.org for more information on that. Mark, thanks for coming on this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.